So today, in my final lecture, I'm going to discuss loops. Okay, so yesterday we were talking about Phi-4 theory. Today we'll go back to the Phi-cube theory that we briefly discussed last week. And so the naive Lagrangian for this theory will just be the Klein-Gordon Lagrangian. Plus a phi-cubed interaction term. Okay. And so the Feynman rule for the vertex of this theory in position space is just IG integral d4x.
Dan, why is there a plus sign
there? So it doesn't really matter here if we use a plus or minus.
So either, minus.
Yeah. Either way, for large positive or large negative values of phi, we'll have a problem that our potential is unbounded below. But we're just doing perturbation theory, so that's not an issue. Okay. So this is our, why am I calling this the naive Lagrangian? So if we want to use the LSD formula, we need to impose omega phi of x, omega equals 0, and k phi of x omega equals e to the I k dot x. Okay? And so last week, I argued that we can impose these conditions by shifting and rescaling phi. And if we do that, then our Lagrangian becomes half z phi partial phi squared minus half zm m squared phi squared plus 1 over 3 factorial zg g phi cubed plus y phi. So this is a linear term. It's a new term we get. And so for particular choices of z and y, we can impose these conditions. So these are not new free parameters. They'll be constrained, as we will see in lecture today, by these conditions. And we'll explore that a bit more in tutorial tomorrow. OK, so how can we determine these z's and y? So if we want to compute omega phi of x omega equals zero, and impose that it equals 0, and see what that tells us about the z's and the y's, then we need to break up our Lagrangian into a free part, which we know how to deal with, and a perturbation. So if we do that, the free part is just the Klein-Gordon Lagrangian. And our perturbation, or the interaction part of the Lagrangian, will consist of two parts. So one is basically something we've already dealt with before. So we can write L interaction as 1 over 3 factorial zg times g phi cubed. So we already know how to deal with this. So if we were doing perturbation theory, our Feynman rule for this 3-point vertex in position space then is the same as before. We just get an extra factor of zg. So that's not a big change. But we also have additional terms. And I'll call these additional terms counterterms. So here, CT stands for counterterms. And our counterterms, we can see just by comparing the two terms we've written down and our total Lagrangian, are we have 1 half z phi minus 1 partial phi squared minus 1 half zm minus 1 m squared phi squared, and then a new term, which I'll call capital Y phi. So this phi is not a subscript. This is the field here. Whereas this one is a subscript. Let's see. OK. And so we've been ignoring these terms before. And as I stated before and will argue later in lecture, that's OK because Y is 0 plus order G. And the ZIs are all 1 plus order G squared. So our strategy for computing the Y and Zs in order to impose those two conditions I wrote on the top board is we're going to compute these perturbatively in G. So we're treating all of both this phi cube term and these additional terms as perturbations to our Klein-Gordon Lagrangian, which we know how to deal with. We do have extra terms here. So we're going to have extra vertices when we write down the Feynman rules for our full theory, including the counterterms. Questions on our strategy?
Yes. So what we did before wasn't completely correct if we had just used this
OSA? So what we did before was correct as long as we're at tree level. So at tree level, these things are just 0 and 1, and we can ignore them. But once we go beyond tree level to loops, then it's not justified to only it's not justified to use that naive Lagrangian I wrote. Down up there.
Sorry, what do you say tree level?
OK, so a diagram that has no loops is tree level. So for instance, this diagram is tree level. Doesn't matter how many external points there are, as long as all of the momenta are determined by the external momenta. This is a tree level diagram. Anything that has a loop, so for instance, this diagram would be a one-loop diagram. If we wrote down the Feynman rules for this thing, this diagram, there would be one undetermined momenta, one momentum integral. This would be a two-loop diagram. Yes?
So even at tree level, we can add as many vertices as we want, right? So we can go to order larger order in G.
That's right.
But that seems if we do that, then we cannot neglect the counter terms anymore. We go to higher order three level.
Perhaps this statement will be more clear when we look at an example in a minute. So ask her again if it's still not clear in about 15 minutes.
Okay.
There were more questions. Did I answer this? Okay. OK. So let's start by the first of these conditions, the condition that omega phi omega is 0, and see what that implies about our terms, our new counterterms. So basically, we want to look at the one-point function. And so that means we have a new vertex here that involves a single field. So we need to have a new vertex corresponding to this y. Ben?
Where you have the vertex on the second board, top left there, is that supposed to be d4x, or are we integrating only over space here now?
Oh, I'm sorry, that should be d4x. Yes, thank you.
You don't have to.
You must.
So there's also new vertices corresponding to Z, phi, and Zm. I'll come to those in a minute. But right now, if we want to look at the one-point function, then we need to understand the new vertex corresponding to y. So again, we'll work in position space. And our new vertex, as unusual, we have a single line coming in and ending. There's only one field, phi, here. So by this x at the end of the line here, I mean a single line coming in and ending. Single line ending. And the Feynman rule for this vertex is I y integral d4x. Okay? And so with this new vertex, we can compute omega 5x omega in terms of Feynman diagrams and see what condition we get for y, what condition we have to impose on y to make this vanish. So at leading order, there are two diagrams that contribute to this. So first of all, there's this diagram where this point here is x. This is y. And so for now, we'll just assume that y is order g. So we'll take that as an assumption and justify it later. And so if y is order g, this diagram is order g. And we have one other diagram we can draw at order g that has just a single external point. And that's this diagram here, which is known as the tadpole diagram. Okay. And so those are the only two diagrams we can draw at order g. If we go to higher order, there'll be other diagrams like this one, and this one. These are both order g cubed. And there's many other diagrams we can draw. But let's just work at leading order for now.
So what does the single line ending mean?
So that is the vertex from our counter term. So it's...
Oh, I see. Okay.
So here, so we had a term in our Lagrangian that was linear in the field. So our propagator has two powers of the field in Lagrangian. Our three-point interaction vertex has three powers. So if we only have one power of the field in the Lagrangian, we just have to have a single line ending. Okay. So we need this to vanish. And we're going to demand that it vanishes at each order. So order by order in G, we need these diagrams to sum to zero.
Previously, we had propagators which were simply like that, right?
So this is zero, is the statement that our one particle states are orthogonal to our zero particle states.
Okay.
So this we use this in our derivation of the LSE reduction formula.
Oh, and it's related to the odd point propagators, or just because we have a single IX? If we have any odd number of
phi
x's, then we'll need it.
So our condition only here is that this one-point function vanishes. This we'll see that this implies something about the higher point correlation functions later, but we're not demanding that the three-point function, for instance, vanishes. But it does not vanish. Yes.
Are we just demanding this for any kind of mathematical reasons, or is it just we're not saying? I mean, just you know, the single point is like if this wasn't zero, then this is one thing. This kind of creation of five is out of nowhere.
We're demanding this because physically we want our one particle states to be orthogonal to our. Yeah, it's not mathematical. We're doing a physical argument here. Yes.
So why is that order g not g?
Well, so this term has a single three-point vertex. So this is order g.
Okay.
And our working assumption is that Y is order G. We'll justify that later. And so this just has one factor of Y.
Ben, what does it mean to say that a line ends?
So we're drawing this diagram here. What we have is a particle that what we're eventually going to show is what we're imposing is that these diagrams cancel, right? So a line ending means that physically, it's hard to think about what a line ending means. It's like we have a particle that disappears instead of propagating. So it's weird physically, but mathematically, we have a linear term in our Lagrangian. So we have the way we derive our Feynman rules, we have to have this unusual counter term in our Lagrangian. Okay, so let's write down the expressions associated with these order G diagrams. Okay, so at order G, we have that omega phi of x omega is equal to, from this diagram, we have I y integral d 4 x delta Feynman propagator from x to y. Then from the other diagram, this diagram, we have half, because there's a symmetry factor associated with this internal propagator, I g integral d 4 Sorry, x is our external point. This should be a y. Maybe this is x. So d4y is our internal point. We have a propagator from x to y and a propagator from y to y. And then we won't write the order g cubed term. So we see that, so we've got this expression. In fact, it factorizes because we can write this as delta f of 0 and pull it out of the integral. And then both terms have an integral d4y delta f x minus y. And so we get a nice expression. It's easy to solve for y. It doesn't, after we pull this out, things simplify a lot. And we get that we can pull out this integral d4y delta f x minus y. And if this is going to be 0, this is not 0 in general. So we need this thing to be 0. And so that means that we have to impose that y is equal to minus a half g delta f of 0. OK, great. So that's our result, and we can proceed to higher order if we want. Does this result look weird to anyone? What's delta f of 0? Yeah, so this is divergent. To see that.
So Dan. Not only are you telling us that you'd be hiding terms from telling us that those terms would be not equal to 3.
Yes, that's what I'm telling you. They are, in fact, divergent. But it's okay, as we will see later. So this is divergent, and let me just show you that explicitly. So this is d4p over 2 pi to the fourth I over p squared minus m squared plus I epsilon e to the minus I p dot 0. So this is 1. And here we've got, we go to spherical coordinates p cubed dp over p squared. So this diverges. So how can we proceed? Claim this is not a problem. So our basic procedure is if we impose a regulator, if we come up with a well-defined way to make this finite, to make this quantity finite and hence y finite, we can then impose our condition that omega phi omega is 0, known as one of our renormalization conditions, compute any physical quantities we want to, and then remove our regulator. And so as we'll see, y is going to cancel out y and these other divergent quantities will cancel out of any physical quantity we're interested in. So as long as our results don't depend on these quantities and the way we regulate them, then it's okay if we just make them finite in any way we like, compute the physical quantities we're interested in, and then remove our regulator. So we'll see how that works. We'll go through one example of how that works in lecture, and you'll see that again in tutorial tomorrow. So one way we could make this finite is we want to keep this Lorentz invariant. So one way we could just impose a cutoff. If we want to keep this Lorentz invariant, then we can take delta f of 0 to be its propagator, its normal propagator, and multiply by some power of p squared minus lambda squared plus I epsilon. And if we square this, so this is Lorentz invariant. If we put this factor in for large p, we have now p to the 6 in the denominator. And this integral becomes finite. And using the techniques that we'll look at in tutorial tomorrow, you can show that, in fact, this then becomes lambda squared over 16 pi squared. So this is divergent. But it will cancel out of all physically measurable quantities.
So it's the divergent in the limit?
In the limit that lambda goes to infinity. So, yeah. So this way of regularizing integrals is called Pauli-Villars. And there's, as I mentioned before, there's many different ways that we'll look at. We won't go through much in lecture today. We won't go through explicit ways to regulate these infinite quantities, but you'll look at an explicit example tomorrow in tutorial. And then in QFT2, we'll come back to this subject in much detail and look at different ways we can regulate these quantities. Yes? Yes.
I'm sorry, I missed how we introduced that term there, the factor of.
Okay, so this is just an example. So this is an example of one way we can make things finite so that we can proceed with our calculation. And then the claim is that this will cancel out of any physical quantities we're interested with. And so then we can, we do this to determine y. Then we go ahead and compute, say, a cross-section. And then we can take the limit lambda goes to infinity. And our result will still be finite in that limit. So only our intermediate quantities will be divergent.
How can you guarantee that the, how do you guarantee that the rho is independent of any regulator? It doesn't seem to me like it's enough to just require your physical property to be independent.
So that's a good question, and we'll come back to that question later. So in tutorial tomorrow will be a better time to answer that question after we see some details.
I just wanted to say that the particular form of the regulator, does it have any physical significance?
Oh, so this you can interpret this as adding a fictitious heavy particle to the propagator. That's not. I won't talk further about this way of regulating. So.
But why does delta F not delta F of zero remain the same when you introduce this factor into the integration?
It doesn't. So we're changing it. We're making it finite.
And you're still calling it delta F of zero.
Yeah. This is the regulated version. So taken infinity, made it something finite. Okay. So after we impose this condition, we get simplifications. So in particular, our condition that we choose y so that we set our one-point function to zero diagrammatically means that we're setting this diagram to be zero. So diagrammatically, where this just means the shaded bubble just means any diagram with no external points. And we can use this to determine y order by order in G. And we're always going to have the same factorization. So this propagator will always factor out. And so that, in particular, means that after we fixed y, this diagram plus this diagram add up to zero, because we've just demanded basically that this loop here plus this counter term give us zero, and it doesn't matter how we connect it to the rest of the diagram. So this is zero, and more generally, any diagram with a tadpole subdiagram is zero. So for instance, we have very complicated diagrams like this diagram. The splinter diagram. So it contains a tadpole subdiagram. So we don't need to compute this. And this is equal to zero.
Sorry, Dan.
Yes?
The restriction you just put on, the top two diagrams above there, are you saying that each of those two are identically zero, or the sum of them is zero?
No, they're not individually zero. Only the sum of these two diagrams is zero.
But if I put anything inside that circle, then will it go to zero? Like if I just put a line, that's
zero. So if we put a line in here, like this, then we would need to include more terms with counter terms in order to cancel this out.
Just putting a line up there does not make that diagram zero.
So this plus this is not zero. So at the next order, would be things like this. So for instance, this plus this plus this plus this diagram here. If that's all the order cube diagrams, then this would still be equal to zero. But we at least need to add in this extra diagram that has another counter term in order to still make the cancellation work.
So I think that blob that you drew has all these higher order corrections.
So it's
yeah.
The sum.
Yeah, so this
it's
is
order by order.
This is the sum of all of these diagrams. Yes?
When you're saying 2y order by order, what is it?
To determine y. So we can use this equation to determine y order by order in G. So the only two diagrams of this form at order G are these two. These are two of the diagrams at order G cubed. There's none at order G squared.
So that equation is mathematically that?
I'm sorry, which equations?
That equation with the diagram?
This one?
Is that mathematically that?
This is mathematically. This is what I mean by 5x.
That is equal to adding the x, y, where the y is just the end of the line and this time.
So this is what I mean by this shaded circle is diagrams of any order.
Oh, okay.
So of any order. In practice, we can't compute them all, but we don't. We don't really need to because we know that the sum of all of them is zero. That's what we're imposing. And that tells us something about the higher point correlation functions. Okay. So that's why. And so we still have three other parameters, the three z's. And let's see what we can say about them. So first, I'll discuss these z phi and zm. So both of these involve two powers of phi. So they're both, you might expect that they both first show up in the propagator of the interacting theory, the two-point function. So let's look at the two-point function. And because there's a derivative acting on phi in the z phi term, it'll be easier to work in momentum space. So let's move from the one-point function to the two-point function and from position space to momentum space. So discuss the momentum space propagator. And we're only going to be interested in the connected part. So let's write the two-point connected momentum space Green's function, completely connected, P and P prime. So this means completely connected. So if it's completely connected, there's going to be a momentum-conserving delta function. And let's just pull that out. And what's left, we'll call G2 of P. And so diagrammatically, we can write G2P as the free propagator plus, so there's a loop correction here. And we'll also have a new term coming from the counter term corresponding to z phi and zm. And so I'm just going to draw that as a line with an x on it, and this is the new counter term. From 1/2 z phi minus 1 partial phi squared minus 1/2 zm minus 1 m squared phi squared.
And does that vertex have two lines coming to it, or is it kind of like two vertices that just happen to be the same?
So this is a, it's a, has two lines coming in. So there's one line going in, one line going out. And we have this vertex. But we need to draw it. So that's the same. We have one propagator connects two different points. We just need a way to distinguish this term, which also involves two powers of the field, from the propagator. So what do we have next? So we'd also have things like this. But we've already canceled these, so I'm not going to draw any further tadpole diagrams. So then these are the only, so this is order one. These are order g squared. So our assumption was that the z's are order g squared. So we'll assume, or 1 minus, 1 plus something g squared. So we'll assume this is g squared. So that's the only terms at that order. But let's keep going and see what we can learn if we go to higher order. So at order g4, we can draw things like this. We also have a term with two counterterm insertions. We also have terms like this plus this. Then we have things like this. And this. So all of these are order G4. But these diagrams in the top row look like the diagrams we already saw at order g squared. So this is just basically two copies of the first g squared diagram I had. This is two copies of the second. These are one copy of each. And so just by looking at this, it suggests a way to reorganize our perturbation series. And we can write g2 in another way. We can write our propagator as just using this idea that these look like several copies of what we have at lower order. We can write this as the free propagator plus all of the one particle irreducible diagrams. So this means one particle irreducible. And that means that it stays connected if we remove any one line. So if we remove, cut any one line. So if we cut this line, it's still connected. But if we cut this line here, the diagram is no longer completely connected. So this diagram is not 1PI. This diagram is 1PI. So if we cut any of these lines, the diagram, any of the internal lines, the diagram remains completely connected. So these last two are also 1PI. These first four at order G4 are of the form 1PI. And if we went to higher order, we'd also have diagrams of the form. We have three sets of 1PI diagrams connected, and so on. So we've just reorganized our perturbation series.
You denoted the cutting on the diagram. What happens to the leftovers after you cut? Like there's like new external points, or they just like.
We're just classifying. We're not actually going to compute anything by cutting them. But if we cut this line, that's why I wrote initially just deleting the line. So we could think of if we delete this line, remains a diagram.
And the non-smooth points will not be vertices anymore.
Right. Okay. We're not going to compute anything after.
To make sure that I get right the equivalence of 1PI.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yes. Yeah. So you can just think of it as just removing that line.
Can we call them 1PI because we have one particle coming in and the same particle going out?
That's right. Okay. So we've reorganized our expansion in terms of Feynman diagrams. And the reason we've done so is that if we write it in this, the way I've written it on the bottom of this board, in terms of a bunch of propagators connecting 1PI diagrams, then we see that our expression for the full propagator takes the form of a geometric series. And so to see that, let's write out the expressions corresponding to these Feynman diagrams. So G2 is, so our first diagram is just the free propagator. It's I over P squared minus M squared plus I epsilon. Our next diagram has two propagators. By momentum conservation, the momentum in this propagator has to be equal to the momentum in this propagator. So we have I over P squared minus M squared plus I epsilon, all squared. We don't know what the Feynman rule is for the 1PI part, but let's just give it a name. So let's call it just I sigma, and it will in general depend on the momentum. So this is just the contribution from the 1PI part. And we can go to higher order. For this next term, we just have three propagators. And two copies of the 1PI diagrams, so that's just I sigma squared. And so as promised, this is a geometric series. And we can sum it. So we can pull out a propagator from everything. And we're left with a sum of sigma of P squared over p squared minus m squared plus I epsilon all to the nth power. And so this is a sum we can do. And if we do the sum, what we get is I over p squared minus m squared plus I epsilon. The sum is 1 over 1 minus sigma over p squared minus m squared plus I epsilon, which is just I over p squared minus m squared minus sigma of p squared plus I epsilon. And so this is our result for G2.
Is that a sum or just a sigma?
Oh, yeah, this is just a sigma. Let's write the sum as like that. Yes, so this is a function. This is a function. This is some function.
That's the self energy.
Yes, this is self energy. Okay. So, if we can say something about sigma, then we can impose some condition on our counter term, the z phi and zm counter term. That will allow us to fix z phi and zm in the same way that we did for y. So it would be useful if we could turn our statement about, I gotta erase it now, but the statement that we wanted k phi omega to be e to the I k x into a statement about sigma. And in fact, we can do that. And so let me just sketch how that works. Any questions about what we've done so far? Yes?
So when we rearrange the terms using the 1PIs,
yes.
So basically we're changing the order of the sum in the perturbation series.
That's right. Yeah.
But each term is a complex number. And even if it converged initially, which it doesn't, like we aren't always allowed to change the order.
We're not. In fact, even our original sum is not a convergent series. It's an asymptotic series. We've already switched mm-hmm. summation and integration. None of what we're doing is actually a convergent series. It's all asymptotic series with, you can compare it to experiments and the results with a low number of loops reproduce our experimental results. So.
But how do we know the answer is unique? If someone came up with a different way of arranging the diagrams, you would probably get a different answer. And how do we know this is the one that will agree with experiments?
So the difference, if you have an asymptotic series, what you could miss are what are known as non-perturbative terms. So things like you have f of x is asymptotic to some asymptotic series. It's also asymptotic to the same series plus, say, e to the minus x squared. And so this is something you miss when you're doing perturbation theory. And so there are ways to compute these terms. Which perhaps in some of the review or exploration courses we'll get into, but I don't want to. That would be a big tangent. So, yes.
Is the derivation you've given us like the best we can do in the law? Criticism is like the serious problem, or is this just kind of something that is all, you know, this simplified thing that you've gone through here and you can do it more rigorously?
For most quantum field theories, we can't do better than this. For particular ones, with enough symmetries, perhaps you can say something exact.
Yes. So in the end, in our diagram sum, do we have any loop?
Yes. So this sigma is the contribution from all of the 1PI. So it includes terms with all loops. Any number of loops. But once we compute these diagrams, we can compute this at any loop order we want, and then plug that in here, and we'll get an approximation to this. But if we could exactly compute the sum, then this equation would hold. In practice, we can't do that. But
anytime we have one of these, like say by a loop, I don't necessarily even mean like, but with multiple edges, let's say one edge which connects to the same vertex twice. We have those.
So this 1PI includes. So we've drawn some examples. So the first two 1PI diagrams are those ordered G squared terms I wrote up there. The next two are this. Two-loop diagram here and this one-loop diagram with a counter term.
I think what Dylan was saying is something that you would get in a 5-4 theory.
For example, well, anytime when you have a vertex that's allowed to have two, so see, for example, the one that we've canceled out in the top right, it has a loop where one edge is connected to the same vertex twice.
When
the tadpoles cancel.
The tadpoles cancel, sure. Yeah.
So do we have any graphs that have loops like that?
So all of the tadpoles will cancel once we fix y.
All of them. Excellent.
Yes.
Okay.
But the order g squared term has those as well, what you're saying. Because the first term in that order g squared, you have three guys going. That's the same locally as the tadpole, right?
Oh yeah, it has a three down vertex.
So that's a spike cubed nature.
Sure, no, I'm okay with that.
Okay. So we'd like to be able to say something about what we expect the interacting propagator to look like based on the fact that we impose that our one particle states are correctly normalized, namely that k phi omega is e to the ikx. So we want to use that to say something about this. And so let's go back to the two-point Green's function in position space. So we'll go back to position space. And for simplicity, let's assume x naught is greater than y naught, so these are already time-ordered. So to say something about this, we can insert the identity. In between 5x and 5y. And if we do that, I'm using the following decomposition of the identity. Let's write it, the identity as the projection onto the vacuum plus the projection onto the one particle states. Plus the projection onto the multi-particle states, so with two or more particles. So those two are, we'll specify the two or more particle states by some number of discrete and continuous parameters, which I'm just collectively denoting by n, and another parameter, which is the total momentum. these are the multi-particle states. Okay, so if we insert this in here, we get three different terms. So the first term is one we've already looked at. It's just the product of two of these things that we've demanded vanish. So this vanishes. Already imposed that and learned how to learn something about y. But we also have terms two other terms. So we have the one particle states. And here we'll get the form factor that we wanted to use to say something about this propagator. And so we're imposing that this, write it down here, is this one is the minus sign, e to the minus ikx. And this one has the plus sign. This is e to the iky. Then we also have the multi-particle states. So I'm not going to carefully deal with the multi-particle states. We'll come back to this argument in QFD2 and treat them a bit more carefully. But what you can show is that this term is 0 for k squared less than m squared if we assume that there are no bound states. Okay, so there are no multiparticle states that have an invariant mass of less than 2 free particles. We have to have at least 2 free particles. If there's no bound states, then there's nothing with less energy than that.
Just one more for the argument of the first correlator going to 0.
Mm-hmm.
So what's the argument for
that? What's the argument? So this, we were, in the LSE formula, we were demanding our one particle states are orthogonal to the vacuum.
Exactly is meant when we draw that cross in the line. I mean, it's the same.
So that's the vertex corresponding to the terminal Lagrangian that's at the top of the top board. The z phi minus 1 partial phi squared, and same with the m squared. So there's an additional Feynman rule we could write for that vertex. So everywhere we could draw a single line, we can also draw this vertex. They have different Feynman rules. So our Feynman rule for the regular line with no cross in it is just to write down the propagator, the Klein-Gordon propagator of the free field. The Feynman rule for that term is similar but involves factors of z phi. And also ZM.
I'm just wondering that if you have a loop like that, then you can say that a particle breaks into two and then again recombines back. What can you say about this crossing vertex? I mean, if you have a loop, then you can say that a single particle is splitting into two and then recombining back.
Okay, yeah, so the physical interpretation, it's harder to physically interpret these counter terms. We need these just to make our theory, but we need to insert these to make our, so that we can do perturbation theory and that our one particle states are what we'd like them to be. They agree with what our intuition from the free theory, but they cancel out of everything physical. So it's, There's not as clean a interpretation in terms of virtual particles. You could probably make one, but it's not clean and
I don't really understand the expression you have for the multi-particle states on the far right there.
Okay.
It seems like each one is only labeled by a single value of k. Why wouldn't we have to, if we have a multi-particle state, why don't we have to list the momenta of each particle?
Yes, we do. So here k is the total momentum.
Right.
And so by this sum integral sign, I mean there's a whole bunch of other parameters we need to specify to specify a multiparticle state.
Okay.
Things like relative momenta,
right.
Particle number, types of each
okay.
particle.
So this should be taken kind of as a shorthand for that.
This is a shorthand for,
okay.
for that, yeah.
Sure.
Okay. So we have one term here, which I've explained. The other one, I've done a little bit of hand waving. We'll come back to this in QFT2. So this term, though, we understand. So this expression, integral d3k over 2 pi cubed 2ek e to the ik y minus x, is exactly the same term we had when we computed. So this is the same as what we got when we computed phi x phi y with the free vacuum. So when we computed the Feynman propagator, we got one term like this. When x naught was greater than y naught, another term in the other case, and that told us that the time-ordered product here was just a Feynman propagator. So we have two terms in this sum that survives. So there's this term. So by the same argument we had in the free theory, the propagator, which is the time order, we would have to input a time order product here instead of just the product, contains exactly the free propagator. And then this other term, which, because we're assuming that there are no bound states, takes this form. And just in the interest of time, I'm not going to go through detailed derivation of where this term comes from. But the key point is that this integral runs from 4m to infinity. So this function has an isolated pole at the physical mass, and the residue is 1.
Do you want to use a different symbol for m there? Is this the same m as in the m in our Feynman problem?
This is the same m because we've demanded, we're doing physical, or on-shell, the on-shell renormalization scheme. Yeah, so this is the physical mass. So what have we learned? So should be clear that we get this term. I haven't fully sketched that where this other term comes from, but this result is what's known as the Chalin-Lehmann spectral representation. And what we get is the key point is that we have a pole at the physical mass, the particle with residue 1. So we have another expression for the exact propagator over here. And what we've just learned tells us something about sigma. So, in particular, if those we have two expressions, two exact expressions for the propagator, they should agree on the location of the poles and the residues of those poles. So we have a residue, a pole at p squared equals m squared with residue 1. And so that tells us that looking at our other formula for G2 of P, this is minus. This tells us that sigma at p squared equals m squared better vanish if the pole is going to be at the same location. And if we want the residue to be the same, the derivative of sigma had better also be 0. So this is, so the poles has the same location. And we also want sigma prime of m squared to be 0, so the residue is the same. And we can use these conditions to determine z phi and zm. We derived, well, I derived one exact expression for the propagator. So this is an exact expression for the interacting propagator. I sketched the derivation of another expression, exact expression for the interacting propagator. And so if they're the same function. So if they're the same function, they should have the same poles. And they should have the same residues at those poles. Yes?
This is derivative with respect to P, right?
This is derivative with respect to P. So this is D with respect to, yeah. Wait, with respect to P squared. There was another question.
I was going to ask. So the G you derived there, that's the free theory?
No, these are both for the interacting theory. This expression is for the interacting theory.
Yeah.
This expression is for the also for the interacting theory. So we have one term that looks like the free theory propagator, and then we have this mess over here.
Where does that come from?
This comes from the multiparticle states. I haven't fully explained where that comes from. It would, just in the interest of time, or, there is another term that comes from the multiparticle states. We'll come back to this in QFT2. And so we can use these conditions to fix Zm and Z phi. again, order by order in G. So if we want to compute a physical quantity to order G squared, then what we need to do is we need to compute the contributions to sigma to G squared, impose, fix the values of Zm and Z phi so that these conditions are satisfied. And then we can compute the physical quantity we're interested in. And it will be independent of the way that we regulated the infinite quantities that will show up in these segments.
So if we figure out what Zm and Z phi are like this, they would be dependent on our cutoff, right?
That's right. Yeah.
So
they will.
We would have to do a perturbation theory which is cutoff dependent.
That's right. And it's the same way as in Y.
But then the end result should not depend on the cutoff.
Exactly. Yes.
So is there implicitly a cutoff going on here? Is it clear?
So if we look at some of the diagrams that contribute, for instance, this diagram. This diagram diverges. So if we wanted to actually do what I said, we would need to impose a cutoff or regulate the contribution from this diagram in some way. And then we could demand that the sum of these two things vanished at when p squared equals m squared, and the derivative with respect to p squared vanished at p squared equals m squared. Then we could compute something physical and remove our regulator.
You said something like we don't have bound states when k squared is less than m squared.
So what I said is we have no bound states. That means that so let's work in the center of mass frame. So if we have two particles, the lowest energy state is where those two particles are at rest. And in that case, if we computed p squared of the system, it would be 4m squared. So the energy would be 2m. If there's any relative momentum, then the total energy of the two particles' state would be greater than 2m. And hence, because there's no total momentum, if we calculated p squared for the total system, the four vector p squared, it would be greater than 4m squared.
I was just wondering what happens when p squared becomes equals m squared. If p squared equals m squared or p squared is greater than m squared, do we say that we have bounds?
So a bound state is a statement about the multi-particle states of the system.
Here we are not.
So this is an expression for the propagator.
Yeah.
The bound states entered when we wanted to compute the overlap of the one particle state phi omega with the multi-particle state kn. We need. I didn't really derive it, but in order to show the result that I gave there, you need to make the assumption that there are no bound states. Yes.
Just to follow up on my earlier question, I guess maybe you think of a different thing when I say cutoff than what I do, but I guess, I mean, is there some kind of length scale or energy scale cutoff that's being imposed?
We can impose our cutoff in a number of different ways. So we could just put a maximum value for the allowed momentum. That's called just a hard cutoff. We could also do, so that in general breaks Lorentz invariance. So sometimes it's used, that can cause problems if you're actually trying to calculate things. So we could do something like Pauli-Villars. I wrote down some expression where it can multiply by some Lorentz invariant thing. In this tutorial tomorrow, you'll look at a third way, dimensional regularization, which is one of the most powerful ways we can impose cutoffs.
In terms of what we've actually done here, though, none of that has been.
So I haven't really been explicit about how you would go about calculating these things. You'll see some of the details of that in tutorial tomorrow.
Okay.
So we described at least schematically how we would go about determining z phi, zm, and y. We have one parameter left, and that's zg. So how can we go about fixing zg? So it's useful to define a vertex function. Which is very similar to a matrix element. The difference is we're not going to impose that our momenta are on shell, basically. So, and by vertex function, just mean, so this is a three-point vertex function. And by vertex function, I just mean all of the 1PI amputated diagrams where all of the momenta are ingoing and not necessarily on shell. So they don't necessarily satisfy k squared equals m squared. Okay. Is that clear? This is the definition. Okay. So how can we compute this? So we can compute this perturbatively. And the first few diagrams, the first two diagrams that contribute to this are this diagram. And this diagram. And we have more contributions if we went to higher order. Okay. And so we can use our Feynman rules to write down the expressions for these diagrams. Remember, the vertex was the easiest of the modifications we had to make to our theory. We don't have to introduce any new vertices. The difference is that our Feynman rule, the factor associated with our Feynman rule, instead of being g, now is zg. So this first diagram is just ZGG times I. Our second diagram has three vertices, so it's I, ZG, G, all cubed. We have one undetermined momentum, L. So momentum conservation wasn't enough to determine L in terms of K1. K2 and K3. So we need to integrate over L. And then we have three propagators here. This is all plus corrections of order g to the fifth. So if zg is equal to 1 plus order g squared, then the only contribution here we need is we already have g cubed here. So if we look at any of the corrections to zg in this term, those will be higher order. So at this order, we can ignore the ZG here. And how can we proceed? So we don't have any other conditions analogous to our conditions omega, phi, omega equals 0, or k phi omega equals e to the ikx left to impose. We've already used those to determine z phi, zm, and y. So in order to fix zg, what we could do is demand that a particular measurement of a cross-section, for example, or a decay rate, depended on g in a certain way. We could do that. In practice, that's difficult, and it's somewhat arbitrary, too. We could choose a different measurement where the particles that are scattering have different momenta and say that that's what we mean by the coupling, or that's what we mean by g, the physical value of g. So there's some arbitrariness here. So the way we can do this in practice is just choose the easiest definition of g. And that tends to be in terms of this vertex function. So we can define choose the definition of g by v3, say, of 0, 0, 0 equals g. And this is just a choice. Other choices would be work equally well. They would tell us the same thing about so once we calibrated one experiment, we did one measure one cross section at some particular energy. We could measure other cross sections, and we'd only need to fix ZG once. So ZG will cancel out of all of our physically measured quantities. Yes.
Like physically, that's not possible, right?
Yes.
Because k has mass.
Right. So that's why I said this is a vertex function. The difference between the vertex function and the matrix element is that we're not demanding these things are on shell. So the reason this thing is useful is you can use it to compute compute matrix elements of, say, 4 or 5 point functions that contain subdiagrams that have things like this. So it's a useful function besides being useful in imposing this renormalization condition. It's useful in computing higher order matrix elements or correlation functions. Okay. And so we'll see an example of how this works in tutorial tomorrow. So you'll actually do this and regularize some of these divergent integrals and see how these renormalization, these counter terms cancel out the ZGs and Ys cancel out as our final answer. Okay. So just have a few minutes left. I just wanted to make a few comments. And we'll come back to all this from a slightly different perspective in QFT2. So.
Dan.
Yes.
You've used this constraint to fix G, not say G.
Sorry?
Have you used this constraint to fix G and not say G?
We'll use this faint constraint to fix ZG. So we'll demand that this holds. So we'll set, say, G is, or probably IG is equal to this. And so there is this term plus this term, and the cancellation needs to occur there. So just a few comments, and a recap of what we've done today. So first, these z's and y's. Y is our formula infinite. Our basic procedure is to regulate these quantities, solve the renormalization conditions, and there were four conditions because we had four, three z's and a y. So one condition was this condition on the vertex function. We had two conditions on the self-energy sigma, and then our tadpole condition. So solve the renormalization conditions. And then the physical quantities are independent. Will be independent. Of the regularization procedure. Okay. Second comment is the way I've presented things is not the only way to do it. there are many, or at least several other ways of thinking about renormalization, and we'll see a few of those, or at least one different way in QFT2. So there are other ways to renormalize. The method I presented here is called the on-shell. Shell method. So just be aware that when you see this again, it'll be presented slightly differently. And there's going to be a lot more on this to come in QFT2. Okay. And so that concludes our discussion of scalars. And next time, I'll hand it over to Tibra, who will tell you about fermions and gauge bosons.